Usually when we talk about a simple action on our computers, there's this underlying expectation of precision. Like you highlight a line of text, you hit copy, you hit paste, and that text appears in the new window exactly as it was. It's a binary function. We basically treat it like a law of physics.
We do, yeah. I mean, we build our entire digital routines around that predictability. But the moment you assume a digital system is infallible, you create a blind spot. And attackers are, well, they're actively exploiting that exact assumption right now.
Which means you are looking at a digital landscape that is actively trying to deceive you. And whether you are a dedicated gamer, a retail crypto investor, or, just someone who occasionally plugs a USB drive into a laptop to share a file, the fundamental rules of your digital safety are shifting beneath your feet. So today we are doing a deep dive into the June 19th, 2026 edition of the Tech and Night Tech and Cyber Analysis Report.
Right, it's a really comprehensive stack of sources today.
It is. And our mission here is to uncover the hidden vulnerabilities, the rapid strategic shifts, and honestly, the macroeconomic forces that are currently dictating the rules of our digital lives and economies. And it all starts with that seemingly mundane action of copying and pasting. Microsoft's threat intelligence team just flagged something called the Crypto Clipper, which has been active since February 2026. Okay, let's unpack this. I understand this begins with a USB drive, but how does moving a simple file compromise the clipboard?
So the initial vector relies entirely on deception. It starts with a malicious Windows shortcut file, an LNK file, sitting on that USB drive, heavily disguised to look like a standard document.
Like a PDF or something.
Exactly. And once a user clicks it, it initiates a worm-like propagation. But before it does anything malicious, it performs a quiet check to see if the machine is already infected. It really wants to avoid creating a noisy, redundant footprint that security software might actually notice.
Oh, that makes sense. So it's staying under the radar.
Right. And if the system is clean, it downloads the primary payload directly into the computer's memory.
Wait, into the memory? Like not onto the hard drive?
Correct. Yeah. It establishes a Tor-based command and control center entirely in the system's RAM. By avoiding the hard drive altogether, it completely bypasses traditional antivirus scans that look for malicious files saved on a disk. From that memory space, it monitors your clipboard, it captures screenshots, and it leaves a permanent backdoor access point.
I have to challenge this, though. I mean, clipboard access is a pretty standard feature. Launching background scripts is a normal Windows capability. If this malware is just using normal tools, why can't enterprise-grade security platforms just step in and block the behavior?
What's fascinating here is that it uses the operating system's own architecture against itself. The malware isn't relying on broken code or like a zero-day software vulnerability. It's actually orchestrating legitimate native Windows features. Yeah, so security software struggles to quarantine it because shutting down those underlying features would effectively break the Windows operating system for the user. But the truly insidious part of this Clipper malware isn't technical at all. It exploits a flaw in human psychology. It uses regular expressions, which is basically just simple pattern matching code, to constantly scan your clipboard for specific character lengths.
Let me guess, the exact character length of a cryptocurrency wallet address.
Specifically, it looks for strings of 26 to 35 characters.
Which is Bitcoin.
Right, or exactly 42 characters, which matches Ethereum. The moment you copy a string matching those parameters, the malware swaps your intended destination address for the attacker's address in a fraction of a second. The psychological flaw here is that the human brain just cannot visually process and verify a random 42-character alphanumeric string. You likely check the first three characters, maybe the last three characters, and if they look somewhat similar, you authorize the transfer.
Yeah, I do that all the time. Just check the start and the end.
Exactly. And the attackers know this, so they generate malicious addresses that visually mimic those exact anchor points.
So you think you're sending funds to your secure cold wallet, but because you didn't manually verify the middle 30 characters of that string, you just wired your money to a criminal enterprise. That is wild. And, if the Clipper malware represents this subtle psychological pickpocket operating in the shadows, there are other threats that don't bother picking the lock at all. They just kick down the front door and completely dismantle the security system. I want to shift to the enterprise level and look at this group operating under the name Gentleman. They seem to be rewriting the rules of corporate extortion entirely.
Yeah, the escalation we are seeing from the Gentleman Group is really unprecedented. I mean, they only emerged in late 2025, but as of the first quarter of 2026, they are officially recognized as a top five active ransomware group globally.
That is a crazy fast rise.
It is. Their rise is entirely driven by their flagship technical framework, known as GentleKiller. To give you a sense of its scale, this tool is actively designed to neutralize over 400 different processes across 48 major enterprise security products. We are talking about the core defenses from CrowdStrike, Microsoft Defender, and SentinelOne.
Wait, how is that even possible?
Mm-hmm.
If I have a world-class enterprise security system and a piece of malware attempts to shut down 400 different defense processes all at once, wouldn't that immediately trigger every alarm in the corporate security center?
Well, it would if it acted recklessly. But GentleKiller employs advanced stealth sequencing. It doesn't just start terminating programs left and right. It first conducts reconnaissance, really evaluating the specific environment it has landed in. Then it carefully unloads kernel mode drivers.
Okay, kernel mode drivers.
Right. To understand why that's so devastating, think of the operating system's kernel as the central fuse box of a building. Traditional antivirus software relies on that fuse box for power and visibility. GentleKiller quietly flips the main breaker before the security cameras can even record that an intruder is in the hallway. Furthermore, it constantly monitors its own actions. So if it senses a defense platform is flagging its behavior, it dynamically rolls back its operations and switches tactics.
It's adapting its evasion strategy in real time. That is, that level of sophistication has to require incredible development talent. Mm-hmm. And from the report, their business model seems perfectly designed to attract exactly that kind of talent. They operate as a ransomware as a service, but their payout structure is just wild.
The economics are staggering, honestly. A typical ransomware group might take a 20 to 30% cut of the ransom, passing the rest to the affiliates.
Those are the independent hackers who actually breach the networks, right?
Exactly, the ones deploying the tool. But Gentleman gives their affiliates an industry-high 90% revenue share. When the average ransom payment in 2026 is sitting at $2.3 million, that 90% cut creates a massive flywheel effect.
It's essentially a Silicon Valley talent acquisition strategy applied to a black market.
That is the perfect way to look at it. Mm. They offer the absolute highest payouts, which attracts the most skilled hackers in the world. Better hackers using the GentleKiller framework result in higher success rates, and higher success rates generate more multi-million dollar ransoms. Even though the core developers only keep 10%, the sheer volume of attacks generates massive capital, which they then reinvest into reverse engineering more security products to make the tool even more unstoppable.
This brings up a massive logical challenge for corporate defense, though. If you are a mega corporation and you know these hyper-advanced tools are out there literally turning off kernel drivers, you spend millions building a digital fortress. But that defensive strategy assumes the attackers actually bother to attack your fortress. The threat landscape seems to be bypassing the perimeter entirely, which brings us to the June 13th breach of Nintendo.
Yeah, the Nintendo incident is a textbook demonstration of the supply chain vulnerability. Large enterprises rely on hundreds, sometimes thousands, of third-party vendors for their daily operations.
So let's break down the mechanics of what actually happened there. The hacking group, ShadowByte33, demanded $2 million from Nintendo. But they didn't penetrate Nintendo's internal network to get that leverage, did they?
No, not at all. Nintendo's internal systems actually remained completely uncompromised. The attackers targeted a third-party vendor called TinyPulse, which is an employee engagement and survey platform. It's actually owned by WebMD. The attackers extracted 859 megabytes of internal data spanning a full decade, from 2016 to 2026, assessing the deep cybersecurity posture of every single vendor who manages employee benefits or handles HR logistics or sends out corporate surveys is incredibly resource prohibitive for a corporation.
It's like installing a retinal scanner and a foot-thick steel door on your house, but then giving your house key to the person you hired to water your plants. But what fascinated me about this breach is what happened when Nintendo refused to pay. The attackers didn't deploy ransomware to shut down TinyPulse's servers. They pivoted to something called extortion as a service. How does that actually work mechanically?
So traditional ransomware requires the complex deployment of encryption software to freeze a company's operations until they pay for the decryption key. Extortion as a service is far leaner. It basically skips the encryption phase entirely. The attackers simply infiltrate the vendor, steal the raw data, and then threaten to release it publicly. Yeah. From an attacker's perspective, this circumvents corporate data backups completely. It really doesn't matter if you have your files backed up. The leverage isn't operational downtime anymore. The leverage is public relations damage and massive regulatory fines.
And the type of data you can pull from a simple employee survey platform is incredibly sensitive. The attackers grabbed unfiltered employee feedback, internal morale indicators, and compensation complaints. For a company as notoriously secretive about its pipeline as Nintendo, there was also the threat of exposing unannounced product information that employees might have just casually referenced in internal project reviews. But even with all that leverage, Nintendo's response to the crisis was remarkably disciplined.
It really was. Their crisis management team handled it perfectly. They issued a factual confirmation of the third-party vendor incident without downplaying the severity, but they also made it unequivocally clear that their own perimeter was secure. It allowed stakeholders to accurately assess the real risk without descending into panic.
So the modern digital economy forces every company to constantly reevaluate how to protect their most valuable asset. For Nintendo, in that moment, the asset was internal corporate data. But another gaming giant, Sony, has just made a massive strategic pivot to protect the value of its core intellectual property. They're officially ending their multi-year experiment of porting their first-party single-player exclusives to PC. The Only on PS5 branding is officially back.
The strategy reversal was formally announced by PlayStation CEO Hideaki Nishino with confirmation from Herman Holst. And to understand the pivot, you really just have to look at the historical sales data. Initially, the strategy seemed brilliant. God of War moved nearly 1 million copies in its first week on PC.
Yeah, 971,000, right?
Exactly. And Spider-Man sold 1.5 million copies in a month. But the momentum just didn't last. A major title like Returnal only saw 185,000 sales. The Last of Us Part 1, arguably one of their most valuable properties, suffered from a disastrous, bug-filled launch and only sold 425,000 copies in its first month. Ultimately, out of 15 major PC ports over 6 years, only four actually met Sony's profitability thresholds.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. I look across the aisle at Microsoft, and Xbox is putting their games absolutely everywhere. Mm-hmm. They are releasing titles on PC day one, and they're even putting formerly exclusive Xbox games onto PlayStation hardware. If Microsoft is casting this massive platform-agnostic net, isn't Sony leaving a fortune on the table by locking an enormous audience of PC gamers out of their ecosystem?
It comes down to the fundamentally different economic model, specifically the Razor and Blades model that separate the two corporations. Yeah. The Razor and Blades concept is simple. You sell the base hardware, the Razor, at a very tight margin, and you make your massive profits on the proprietary Blades, which are the games and subscriptions. Microsoft's balance sheet does not rely on selling Xbox hardware. They have Azure cloud infrastructure, Windows enterprise licensing, and massive B2B services. Xbox can afford to function purely as a software and subscription play, driving users toward Game Pass regardless of the screen they are looking at.
Right. Microsoft is essentially a cloud company that just happens to make games. Mm-hmm. Sony doesn't have an enterprise cloud division to fall back on.
Exactly. Sony Corporation's financial engine is PlayStation. In fiscal year 2025, the PlayStation division generated $18.2 billion in revenue and $2 billion in operating profit. That entire ecosystem depends heavily on preserving the hardware margins. The $500 PS5 console is the gateway. When consumers learn they can simply wait a year or two and play a superior, moddable version of a PlayStation exclusive on their PC without even paying for a monthly PlayStation Plus subscription, it dilutes the core value proposition of buying the console in the first place.
They were basically actively dulling their own Blades. Although they aren't abandoning PC entirely, right? Live service games that require massive player counts to survive, like Helldivers 2, which sold 12 million copies with a huge portion on PC, will remain cross-platform. But the premium, narrative-driven intellectual property is going back into the vault to protect the hardware.
It is a deliberate move to restore the premium aura of the PlayStation brand.
It's fascinating because corporate strategies, whether it's Sony protecting its hardware margins or a ransomware cartel adjusting its affiliate revenue shares, none of that happens in a vacuum. Everything is anchored to macroeconomic gravity. The cost of money dictates the global appetite for risk, which brings us to the absolute bloodbath we just witnessed in the markets following the June 17th Federal Open Market Committee meeting.
Yeah, this was Kevin Warsh's first major meeting as the new Fed chair.
And what's wild is that on the surface, they didn't actually do anything. It was a unanimous 12-2 vote to hold interest rates steady at 3.5 to 3.75%, just a hold. But that simple pause triggered absolute carnage in the crypto markets. Over $350 million in leveraged positions were liquidated in just 24 hours, and 89% of those were long positions. Bitcoin plunged 5.3%, breaking critical technical support at $64,000, dropping all the way to $62,679. So what does this all mean? How does a simple decision to keep rates exactly the same wipe out $120 billion in total crypto market cap overnight?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the market reaction wasn't about the current rate at all. It was entirely about the forward guidance provided by the dot plot. Leading into the meeting, the market had largely priced in the expectation of eventual rate cuts. But the dot plot, the visual chart where individual Fed members project where future interest rates will be, was incredibly hawkish. 9 of the 18 members actively forecasted another rate hike before the end of 2026.
The market suddenly realized the era of cheap money wasn't coming back anytime soon. But why is the Fed still considering rate hikes?
Because the underlying economic data refuses to cool down. Core PCE inflation, which stands for personal consumption expenditures, the Fed's preferred gauge because it tracks what people actually spend money on while stripping out volatile food and energy costs, is stubbornly stuck at 2.6%.
Right. They want it at 2%.
Exactly. On top of that, services inflation is running hot at 3.8% due to sticky wages, and May payrolls came in incredibly strong at 285,000 new jobs. Warsh is signaling that he will prioritize taming inflation over stimulating short-term growth. Risk assets, particularly cryptocurrencies, act as a sponge for excess liquidity. When the Fed signals that monetary conditions will remain tight, that speculative liquidity evaporates, and retail traders using high leverage just get wiped out.
But the data in the report also highlighted a major counter-narrative happening underneath all that retail panic selling. The long-term holders were doing something very different.
This is a vital metric for understanding market cycles. While $350 million in leveraged retail positions were being liquidated, on-chain data showed that long-term holders actually accumulated 125,000 Bitcoin throughout June. These are institutional players and early adopters with lower cost bases and multi-year time horizons. Historically, when this demographic accumulates aggressively during a price drop, it indicates that smart money views the macro fear as a buying opportunity.
It's essentially a massive transfer of assets from impatient, overleveraged traders to patient capital. And while Bitcoin is wrestling with these macroeconomic headwinds, the broader crypto industry is still fighting aggressively for institutional legitimacy. That push for legitimacy is going to be front and center at the upcoming Ripple Swell conference this October in New York.
It is the 10th anniversary of Swell, actually, and for the first time they are merging the institutional banking conference with the XRPL Apex Developer Summit. We can expect roughly 1,500 attendees focusing heavily on real-world asset tokenization, decentralized finance infrastructure, and AI integration.
But let's be honest, the loudest conversation driving retail interest isn't about AI integration. It's the rumor of a BlackRock XRP exchange traded fund. Some analysts are completely convinced an application is imminent. Yet BlackRock executives, despite publicly praising the XRP ledger for its real-world utility, have explicitly denied the rumors twice. Why are they so aggressively shutting down the ETF hype?
The hurdle is regulatory limbo, which poses an unacceptable risk for a massive asset manager. Yes, the 2025 SEC settlement provided some clarity by determining that XRP is not a security in secondary market sales. But the legal classification of institutional sales remains murky. BlackRock manages trillions of dollars. They do not launch highly visible financial products if there is a risk of immediately being tied up in federal litigation. They require absolute certainty.
So the legal risk just outweighs the potential profit.
Especially when you look at the recent market reality. The Bitcoin spot ETFs generated around $800 million in net inflows.
Which sounds like a lot.
That is a respectable number, sure, but it fell far below the $3 billion that institutions had originally projected. If the flagship cryptocurrency ETF is underperforming institutional expectations, there is zero business incentive for BlackRock to take on massive regulatory risk to launch an ETF for an alternative asset.
So as an investor listening to this, the actionable advice is to completely tune out the ETF noise.
An XRP ETF is likely a 2027 reality at the earliest, and that assumes Congress passes comprehensive crypto legislation. Listeners should ignore the speculative hype cycle and focus on the fundamental drivers being presented at Swell. How fast is the XRPL DeFi ecosystem actually growing, and are major global banks actively utilizing it for real-world asset tokenization? That infrastructure is where the long-term value will be built.
We have covered a massive amount of ground today. We started with the psychological deception of the crypto clipper malware writing on USB drives and scaled up to the corporate devastation of the gentleman ransomware cartel using a 90% revenue share to monopolize black market talent. We explored how extortion as a service groups bypass perimeters entirely by targeting third-party vendors like TinyPulse, leading to Sony's billion-dollar pivot to protect its exclusive PlayStation IP. Finally, we navigated the macro forces of the Federal Reserve, wiping out highly leveraged crypto traders while patient capital quietly accumulated assets. For you listening right now, you can apply this immediately. Go into your Windows settings and disable auto run for USB drives so malicious worms cannot execute themselves. When you are transferring crypto, force yourself to manually verify the middle characters of the wallet address, not just the beginning and the end. And recognize that whether you are an executive at a gaming giant, a PC gamer, or a retail investor analyzing a Fed dot plot, you are a participant in a highly complex, interconnected risk ecosystem.
Before we wrap up, there is one deeply provocative concept mentioned in the intelligence reports that we need to consider. We spent time analyzing the Gentleman Ransomware Cartel's ability to generate multi-million dollar payouts, which funds the continuous research and development of super weapons like Gentle Killer. The uncomfortable question is, who is ultimately funding that research? This brings up the moral hazard of corporate cyber insurance.
Oh, wow. Explain the mechanics of that moral hazard.
Major corporations carry insurance policies specifically designed to minimize business disruption in the event of a breach. Often, these insurance companies quietly authorize paying the multi-million dollar ransoms because it is simply cheaper than the operational cost of the corporation being offline for weeks. But from a macroeconomic perspective, those massive guaranteed insurance payouts are the exact economic engine incentivizing and funding the development of more sophisticated malware. The critical question we really have to ask is whether the financial safety net we built for corporations is actually the very thing feeding and accelerating the monster.
That is a chilling thought to end on, that the cure might actually be fueling the disease. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive, because as we've learned today, the most dangerous threats in our digital lives aren't always the complex perimeter-breaching hacks. Sometimes, the greatest risk hides in a simple, everyday action, like copying and pasting a line of text.